My fellow Americans, my name is Tinker Spain. This report you're about to hear is an urgent request for action. This report could have been brought to you by professional speakers, but it is not. Just plain, everyday, ordinary Americans, such as myself. We can no longer shirk our responsibilities to ourselves or our families to save this great nation. May God bless you and your families. At this time, I would like to introduce to you Ed Petrowski.
To be able to call oneself American has long been a source of pride for those fortunate enough to live in this great land. The word America has always been synonymous with strength in the defense of our highest ideals of liberty, justice, and opportunity, not only for ourselves, but for those throughout the world less fortunate than we. America's greatest strength has always been her people, individuals laying their differences aside to work in partnership for common goals. In our greatest moment, it has been the willingness to join together and work as long and as hard as it takes to get the job done, regardless of the cost that has been the lifeblood of this great land. From America's inception, we have been a nation of innovators, unfettered by hidebound convention, a safe harbor for captains unafraid to boldly chart a new course through unfettered waters. This courage to dare greatly to achieve great things has made our nation strong and proud, a leader of men and of nations from the very first days of her birth. And since the days of her birth, millions of men and women whose hearts yearn for freedom and the opportunity to make a better life for themselves and their families have journeyed, often enduring terrible hardships, to our shores to add their skills and their dreams to the great storehouse of hope known as America. The pilgrims, the founding fathers, the pioneers, the brave men and women who fought and endured to the end in wars both civil and international. This history of heroism and dedication in defense of ideals both personal and national has long been a treasured legacy of bravery and determination against all odds, and we have handed down like family heirlooms from generation to generation. For we, like family, we Americans often quarreling among ourselves, but banding together in times of adversity to support one another and fight side by side against a common foe threatening our way of life, this bold and brash, brave young land has long given its best and brightest to lead our country to its lofty position in the world as a bastion of freedom and a beacon of hope for all the peoples of the earth. For many, the dreams they had for America were dreams they never lived to see fulfilled. But it mattered not to them, for their vision for this nation was meant to last longer and to loom larger than a mere mortal lifespan. Our national vision of integrity and responsibility, of concern for one's fellow man, the flame inside that demands of us that we shall not rest until there is peace and justice for all. These are fundamental stones which form the strong foundation of our national purpose and our national identity. On this foundation rest not only the hopes of those blessed to live in this great land, but the hopes of millions throughout the world who believe in and strive for a better life for themselves and their posterity. For hundreds of years, the knowledge that America was there, proud, generous, steadfast, courageous, willing, and able to enter the fray whenever human rights were threatened or denied, has given many who may never see her shores the will to endure despite the pain, to continue trying sometimes against surmountable odds. Yet without the vigilance and constant tender care, even the strongest foundation shows the effects of stress and erosion. Even the most imposing edifice can eventually crumble and fall. So it is with nations and with a nation's spirit. We have seen in this second half of the 20th century great advances in technology. They have impacted every aspect of modern life. Ironically, though we are living in an age of communication, it often seems as though we have less time now to talk and to listen. For most modern conveniences, having gotten them off the treadmill, they have only made our treadmill go faster. Quietly yet rapidly, the small town values of community and common purpose are vanishing. Instead of strength in numbers, we as a nation are increasingly being split into smaller and smaller competing factions. The cry of every man for himself is ringing throughout the land. It seems that the phrase divide and conquer has taken the place of one nation under God, indivisible, with truth and justice for all. Americans are retreating behind the locked doors of their individual homes. They are afraid to enjoy the sunset for fear of the darkness it will bring. When and where did all this begin to crumble? How and why has America, which was once a nation with strength and was much more than the sum of its total parts, begin to break apart into bitterly opposing special interest groups? What will the frightening pattern of the disintegration mean to the future of America and to our children? Let it be remembered, and remembered well, the words of the Holy Bible. A house divided against itself cannot stand. And let us not flinch from this truth that we have become a nation desperately divided. With the long legacy of pride, determination, and strength in unity, how is it that we have come to this point that we are fighting amongst ourselves? Finally, and most vitally important of all, what can we do to turn the tide before the values of opportunity, which others before us fought and died for, to preserve, are washed away in the flood to come? What you are about to see is the result of years of painstaking and meticulous research on the part of dedicated Americans, just like yourselves, gravely concerned for this nation's future. Please listen closely and give your undivided attention to this presentation. Your future as individuals and free citizens of this mighty nation depend on it. We are not here to showcase personalities. The speakers could be any one of you. We are here first and last, concerned Americans, much like yourselves, taking our stand in defense of the nation we love. Much effort has been expended and great hardships endured by the American Agriculture Movement and many other organizations and individuals to bring this information to the public forum. There is a wealth of information about many of the problems we as a nation face today, written from a variety of viewpoints. But as with a deadly illness, there is usually a point of origin from which the threat was first given. Ladies and gentlemen, it was a little over 2 years ago that we discovered the introduction to one of the leading documents that we are going to present to you in this study. This single page has led to the study that you are about to receive and join in. It was this study that led and traced back to a single point in time, a time when our nation was in trouble and great despair. It was at this point when our nation struggled for its survival that the Constitution of this United States of America was effectively canceled. We are in a state of emergency.
Thank you. I'm sure, as you have watched the news forecast in the last month or two, and probably even in the last several years, you probably have asked yourself many a time, why is it so difficult to have an understanding of what they are explaining on the news? And then in the last few weeks, you probably have seen on your newscast where our government has kept secrets and hidden documents from all of us. For instance, over 204 atomic tests we were never told about. Thousands of Americans received radiation, but not with their consent. People was giving LSD shots without their consent. We use mustard gas upon our own citizens without their consent. You say, is this America? Could this happen in America? It did, folks. There is another great document that has been kept a secret from the American people. On March the 9th, 1994, it has been kept a secret for 61 years. You say, what could this be?
It is the secret that's going to be unfolded by Dr. Eugene Schroeder. What else should we take a look at today? Why has America lost its way? I'm sure you've heard it over and over. Is our government out of control? I think we can answer that question. Is it out of control morally? By this Bible, it is. Is it out of control financially? If we can believe our public elected officials, they say we now owe over $4.5 trillion. We have went from the world's richest nation to the world's greatest debtor nation. Why? Have we lost our way? Has there been a criminal act committed? By the law dictionary, there has. Can we prove this? Do we need to prove this? Or do we need to prove it to ourselves? At this time, I would like to introduce to you a great American in my eyesight, my neighbor of a lifetime, a friend of America, a friend to all, and one who can explain in depth every government slide. Ladies and gentlemen, Dr. Eugene Schroeder.
Thank you. The study we're going to do today is a study of war and emergency powers. The documents we will be going through are all government documents. That these are not things we're going to say. We're simply going to review what the government has had to say about this subject. So as we go through this review, it is not to say that we agree with the principles that are being proposed. But to understand, we will use these documents to show where the government claims its authorities. And let's begin the study with a document that comes from a well-renowned political author, Schweitzer. And in his book, Constitutional Development, the first paragraph of the introduction says, "We may well wonder, in view of the precedents now established," said Charles E. Hughes in 1920, "whether constitutional government, as heretofore maintained in this republic, could survive another great war, even victoriously waged." Now, what could our Supreme Court Justice, Mr. Hughes, be talking about at this point? He's saying that, in view of the precedents now established, that if this country fights another great war, that we could lose our constitutional republic, even if we win the war. Now, that's hard to understand, that if we fought a war and won it, that we could end up losing our Constitution. But he goes ahead and says that the conflict known as the World War has ended, as far as military hostilities were concerned, but was not yet officially terminated. Most of the war statutes were still in effect, and many of the emergency organizations were still in operation. From that, let's go to an Exhibit 9 from 1933. And this is Congressman Beck reading in the Congressional Record. And Congressman Beck says, "I think of all the damnable heresies that have ever been suggested in connection with the Constitution, the doctrine of emergency is the worst. It means that when Congress declares an emergency, there is no Constitution. This means its death. It is the very doctrine that the German Chancellor is invoking today in the dying hours of the parliamentary body of the German Republic. Namely, that because of an emergency, it should grant to the German Chancellor absolute power to pass any law, even though that law contradicts the Constitution of the German Republic. Chancellor Hitler is at least frank about it. We pay the Constitution lip service, but the result is the same." So here we see Congressman Beck bringing up some of the same principle, that once an emergency is declared, there is no Constitution, that the Constitution is suspended. Relating back to the same thing that Chief Justice Charles Hughes talked about in 1920, that if we fight a war, we could lose our Constitution, even if we won the war. Congressman Beck goes ahead and says, but the Constitution of the United States as a restraining influence in keeping the United States government within the carefully prescribed channels of power is morbid, if not dead. We are witnessing its death agonies. For when this bill becomes a law, if unhappily it becomes a law, there is no longer any workable constitution to keep the federal government within the limits of its constitutional powers. Congressman Beck was speaking in this case of the Farm Bill. This document goes ahead and says that the Farm Bill was passed by a vote of more than 3-1. So if that be the case, and an emergency is declared in this country, and when it's declared, the Constitution is suspended, then that means that we could possibly lose our rights and our freedoms under that emergency power. Let's now go to Senate Report 93-549, a document that was written by our United States Senate in 1973. And let's read the first sentence of the foreword. It says that since March the 9th, 1933, the United States has been in a state of declared national emergency. Now go back to what Congressman Beck said. He says, of all the damnable heresies that have ever been suggested in connection with the Constitution, the doctrine of emergency is the worst. Because it means that when Congress declares an emergency, there is no Constitution. And in 1973, our Congress is stating that since March the 9th of 1933, the United States has in fact been in a state of declared national emergency. That same document, reading on, says, under the powers delegated by these statutes, the President may seize property, organize and control the means of production, seize commodities, assign military forces abroad, institute martial law, seize and control all transportation and communication, regulate the operation of private enterprise, restrict travel, and in a plethora of particular ways, control the lives of all American citizens. Reading on from this same document at Exhibit 11, we find that a majority of the people of the United States have lived all their lives under emergency rule. For 40 years, freedoms and governmental procedures guaranteed by the Constitution have in varying degrees been abridged by laws brought into force by states of national emergency. And in the United States, action taken by the government in times of great crisis have, from at least the Civil War, in important ways shaped the present phenomenon of a permanent state of national emergency. So if this be the case, and that an emergency could be declared in this country, then we should find evidence of that in the supreme laws of our land, in the Constitution. And if we go to Article 1, Section 9 of our Constitution at Exhibit 12, we find the privilege of the writ of habeas corpus shall not be suspended unless when in cases of rebellion or invasion the public safety may require it. The writ of habeas corpus, the great writ of liberty, which says the American people are free from the abuses and usurpations of the power of government. Because if government tries to use its arbitrary prerogative power against the people, we the people retain the great writ of liberty, which says that if you try to do anything to us that is in violation of the procedural due process of law, we retain the great writ. We file the writ and you have to release us. So there we see that government could not abuse its people. But we also find that it says unless, when in cases of rebellion or invasion, the public safety may require it. So here it's contemplated that during a time of great peril, like an invasion of a foreign foe, then yes, we the people gave our government the power to suspend that great writ in order to protect us against that invasion. And it was very vivid that once the invasion was over, though, then we must return back to the normal peacetime constitution and the limitations of the powers of that government. We also look at Exhibit 13, Amendment 5 to our Constitution, and it says that no person shall be held to answer for a capital or otherwise infamous crime unless on a presentment or indictment of a grand jury. So here we see again that the federal government cannot charge our people with a crime, that we reserve that right to ourselves and said that the only way one of our people can be charged with a crime is if we, the people, through the grand jury, order the government to do it. But then we went ahead and said, except in cases arising in the land or naval forces or in the militia, when the actual service in times of war or public danger. So again, we see it contemplated that in times of great public danger, the indictments of the grand juries could be suspended, and that the government could then, in order to protect us, use that power against we the people. From Senate Report 93-549, we read that they, the government, are quite careful and restrictive on the power, but the power to suspend is specifically contemplated by the Constitution in the writ of habeas corpus. So you see that our congressmen were well aware of that when they wrote in 1973 that the suspension of the Constitution was specifically contemplated in the same Constitution. Our Congress said in 1973 that we were in a permanent state of national emergency and had been in that emergency since March the 9th of 1933. But now it's 1994, and if, in fact, we were still under that state of emergency, we should expect to be able to find evidence of that in the current law. If we go to Title 12 U.S.C., the current law that exists today, and go to Section 95B, we can read that the actions, regulations, rules, license, orders, and proclamations heretofore or hereafter taken, promulgated, made, or issued by the President of the United States or the Secretary of the Treasury since March the 4th of 1933, pursuant to the authority conferred by subsection B of section 5 of the Act of October the 6th, 1917, as amended, are hereby approved and confirmed. Cited at March 9th, 1933, Chapter 1, Title 1, of 48 Statute 1. Now, what's this saying? It's saying that the current law says that every proclamation issued by the President or the Secretary of the Treasury since March the 4th of 1933 are approved and confirmed. And it says that this authority is being conferred by subsection B of section 5 of the Act of October the 6th, 1917. So in order to understand that more thoroughly, we probably need to go to March the 4th and see what was happening on that day. If we remember our history, we realize that President Roosevelt was inaugurated on March the 4th of 1933. And if we go to his inaugural address, we find that he says, "I am prepared under my constitutional duty to recommend the measures that a stricken nation in the midst of a stricken world may require. These measures, or such other measures as the Congress may build out of this experience and wisdom, I shall seek within my constitutional authority to bring the speedy adoption. But in the event that Congress shall fail to take one of these two courses, and in the event that the national emergency is still critical, I shall not evade the clear course of duty that will then confront me. I shall ask the Congress for the one remaining instrument to meet the crisis, broad executive power to wage a war against the emergency, as great as the power that would be given to me if we were in fact invaded by a foreign foe." So we see Title 12 saying that since March the 4th, everything's been approved and confirmed. And on March the 4th, we see President Roosevelt asking the Congress for the war powers. Now, let's see if he got those war powers. On March the 5th, President Roosevelt, in Proclamation 2038, asked for a special session of Congress. That special Congress was called for March the 9th. Now, on March the 9th, at 48 Statute 1, Congress passed its first act. If we look at the enabling portion of that act, we can read that being enacted by the Senate and House of Representatives of the United States and America of America in Congress assembled, that the Congress hereby declares that a serious emergency exists, and that it is imperatively necessary speedily to put into effect remedies of uniform national application. So here we see Congress saying that a serious emergency exists, and that now under the rules of necessity, we're going to put into effect remedies of uniform national application. We must understand what the rule of necessity is. Necessity is a rule, a paramount rule of law, and it simply says that necessity knows no law. This is the rule of self-defense. We know that the law of self-defense says, thou shalt not kill. But yet we also know that in times of dire emergency, when one's life is in danger, that the law says that you can kill if it's to protect your own life. The rule of self-defense. That is the rule of necessity. That once the rule of necessity is declared, that it overrides all other law. That it allows one to do something that would otherwise be unlawful. So here we say in the enabling portion on March the 9th that Congress, under the rules of necessity, is going to pass an act that immediately tells us one thing, that if it's going to be passed under necessity, it would otherwise be unlawful. It would otherwise be unconstitutional. And let's see what the first section of that act says. It says that the actions, regulations, rules, license, orders, and proclamations heretofore or hereafter taken, promulgated, made, or issued by the President of the United States or the Secretary of the Treasury since March the 4th, 1933, pursuant to the authority conferred by subsection B of section 5 of the Act of October the 6th, 1917, as amended, are hereby approved and confirmed. Where did we just read those same exact words? Title 12, U.S.C. 95B, the current law in the United States Code today, is Title 1, Section 1 of 48 Statute 1, March 9, 1933. We continue under that state of emergency, under the rules of necessity, to this day. Now, we find that the authority conferred under Title 1, Section 1 of 48 Statute 1, codified today at Title 12 U.S.C. 95B, the powers conferred are under the authority of the Act of October the 6th, 1917. So if that be the case, let's go to that Act of October the 6th, 1917, and see what that Act is. We read that Act. It's entitled, An Act to Define, Regulate, and Punish Trading with the Enemy. Now, we've got to realize that in 1917, this country went into World War I. And as a result, we realized that there were probably enemies of this country residing within the continental shelves of our country. So, consequently, under this Trading with the Enemy Act, our government took the power to take total authoritarian control over those enemies. But we also see at Section C of this Act that these authorities could not apply to citizens of the United States. That the citizens of the United States, not being enemies of the United States, were specifically excluded from the war powers of this Act and from that total authoritarian control of government.